and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on smart speaker, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we're asking, have we scored yet? In association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, the long wait to see us at home in 2024 is over, and my God, that's 90 minutes of our lives we're not going to get back. But, alas, it's another point to the total, which has us lifted us above Manchester United in the table on goal difference. This weekend, we've got our tinfoil cups at the ready, as we all get a dose of cup fever as we head to Sheffield United. And then, on Tuesday, we're back in league action to face an improving Luton Town at Kenilworth Road. In other news, we have completed the signing of Argentinian starlet Valentin Barco, who will join up with the squad in February. And we've also seen the highly rated Adrian Mazulu come to Brighton and then head straight to Holland to link up with Vitesse Arnhem, where we'll hook up with a certain Davy Proper. Joining me today is, as ever, Alan Wares. Justin Brendel is with us. And we also welcome back a man who has worked under six different managers at the Albion, seeing three promotions, two relegations, seafront marches, victory parades, great players, some not-so-great players, two Freddie Mercury impressions, and one 24-inch sausage roll. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Bob Booker! Good evening, Bob. How are you?
Hi, guys. How you all doing?
Yeah, not so bad.
We're not as good as you, Bob, because we're sat here, and we've got Storm Jocelyn blowing around us as we speak, and we're watching you sat there in your villa in Spain. It's just not fair.
Well, it's a bit strange. I mean, it's been about 20 degrees here today. So
stop
yes,
it.
Yeah, just to rub it in a little bit. I know you've been having a bit of a bad time back there, but hey-ho, it's got to be done. Someone's got to do it. So, we're out in sunny Mallorca at the moment.
I was about to say, give us a flavour exactly where you are, mate.
We are based at the top of the island, a place called Porta Palenza. So it's
right.
It's right at the north of the island.
And how many villains have you got for neighbours?
Sorry?
How many villains have you got for neighbours?
Well, not many at the moment with the 90-day exclusion on the all the expats have seemed to have disappeared. So
yes.
It's only us people paying our Spanish taxes that can stay here.
Okay. Yes.
Well, now, Bob, I mean, it's great to see you again. Now, obviously, you've got a brilliant history with the Albion. Obviously, we're playing one of your old teams, Sheffield United, at the weekend as well. But actually, the three teams that you actually play for, do you find it ever so slightly odd that they're actually all in the Premier League now?
Well, I didn't play for Brighton. I was assistant manager at Brighton. But the other two, Brentford and Sheffield United,
the ones you're linked with, apart from Watford.
Yeah. Well, I started as a kid at Watford, but that didn't last very long. I got released when there was a power cut, and I never got asked to come back. So, that was that. But finally started my trade at Brentford, and had 10, sort of 12 years there, and then sort of late in the career, went to Sheffield United, where it all sort of went a bit mental, and we got into the promised land of the First Division and back-to-back promotions. It was a bit like deja vu then, coming back to Brighton and being on the staff and getting back-to-back promotions. It was a very similar scenario and sort of two very similar squads at the time. You know, at Sheffield United, we were a team of nobodies. No one really knew us. And with the squad that Mickey put together, you know, we was a team of thugs that took the league by storm.
So, I've got to mention this, Bob. Now, obviously, when we put this out, we do this on Zoom so we can all see each other. Just quickly tell us about, and this goes along nicely with the shirt of the week, which we're not running for you, but tell us what you've got on your chest at the moment.
I just managed to look. I've got a few collections over here, and I just found this one, which I dug out the drawer today to do a few jobs in, and it was the back-to-back promotion T-shirt, 2001, 2002.
Now, this begs the point, because we were sort of briefly discussing this just before we came on air. 2002, so we're now talking 22 seasons ago. Yeah. How does it feel that, you know, you're wearing a T-shirt that's older than some of our strikers?
Well, first and foremost, I'm glad I can still get in it. that is a bit scary. Like you say, the likes of Jack Inchelwood and people like that, you know, when these T-shirts were given out at the Withdean that night, when we got promotion. How it ended up in here in Mallorca, I do not know. I brought a lot of stuff over here because there's a lot of Spanish friends over here that like English football. So it's been handed out on the island, but I just managed to keep this one. And most of my stuff I've given away over the years.
Yeah.
It felt quite good putting it back on today. I've got to say, it brought back a lot of memories.
Sure. Now, Bob, I mean, last night at the Amex, James Milner made his 686th Premier League appearance. He made his debut. Now, this is going to make us all feel a little bit old because I actually remember this game vividly. He made his debut on the 10th of November 2002. Now, do you know where we were that weekend?
December 2002.
Whatever it was, we'd have been in the second tier.
Yeah. I'll give you a clue. We're playing Wolves.
Wow.
Which book? Is that the days when we used to beat them?
Was that when Bobby Zamora done the chip over?
Yeah. Over Matt Murray, yeah.
Steve Thornton was manager, yeah. And Michelle.
Yeah, that was the same weekend that James Milner made his debut.
Wow, that's incredible.
I mean, I'll say, Bob, it comes to something when you know, we've got Jack Inchelwood, who's even at 18, I'm sure we'll talk about him a bit further into the show. And like I say, you coached his dad. And at that point, you think, Al, shut up.
I think that all the time.
But tell us, in that case, I mean, if assuming that Jack's going to be a chip off the block, tell us what Adam was like to coach and train.
Well, he was, you could see him, if he'd have stayed fit, would have been one of those not too dissimilar to the Jane Milners and that type. Who would have been longevity at a football club, because he was a pleasure to work with. He worked every day. He was disciplined. He just loved the game. He just loved defending. There was no sort of real, you know, techniques with him. He was just, you wouldn't want to play against him as a centre forward. He was a bit like a Danny Cullop, that sort of elk. But he was, yeah, I mean, the Inchelwood family, you know, we've had the manager, haven't we? You know, he's done the youth section. That's a very proud family to see Jack coming through and scoring his first Premier League goals as a father sitting in the stand. I'll bet there was a few tears, you know, holding back a few tears. And it's just a great story. And he plays and looks like his dad. He's just hungry for the game.
Yeah.
He just looks hungry to enjoy himself. You know, he's got a good engine on him. He can get up and down. He's managed to get a couple of goals. Sometimes I think, oh, blimey, he's meant to be playing right back today. And all of a sudden, he's flying in on the back post, getting on chances. So long may that continue. So, he might, you know, and it goes back to the manager having the thought to put him in and not have no fear. You know, the boy doesn't look, you know, all the young players in that squad don't look like they've got any fear. Yeah. And that's installed from the manager on the training pitch.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. There was a brilliant interview, which you should seek out. Actually, there was one. There's one in the Roar archives as well with Martin Inchelwood. But last week, Martin was talking about young Jack, and he was talking about Adam as well. And he was actually saying that Adam had the potential to go all the way, and he got called up into the. Into the under-21s, didn't he, at the time? And basically, there was a lot of talk that he had the potential to actually play at the highest level. But like you said, injuries curtailed all that.
The injury thing was a problem. I had a cruciate injury, bad one, in 1986. And I was particularly lucky to get back from that, because not many players do, especially then many years ago when the technology wasn't there like they've got these days in surgery. And Adam had one very, very similar. And because he was so brave and because he was so fearless in the tackles, he really needed to adjust his game a little bit once he was getting over that injury. And unfortunately, he didn't. And it just kept breaking down and breaking down, you know, through his own, you know, his own persistence to try and be at the top level. And his game was tackling and heading and you know, block tackles and things like that. And it was such a shame that he couldn't make it. He had so many comebacks. It was sad to see him in the gym trying to get through on a daily basis. It was quite sad, because he was a great lad and you know, really good pro.
Does it surprise you that therefore I'm guessing out of the answer here, but does it surprise you he's doing so well at Worthing?
Not really, because the enthusiasm, you know, he's probably, it's a bit like myself, you know, once you sort of have to retire from football for an injury, which I was told, you start thinking, what am I going to do? That's all I've done since I was 17. In my case, Adam was even younger. And all of a sudden, you're in the big, what I call the real world. You know, you've got to go and get a job. You know, you might have a mortgage. You've got to pay your bills. And when you're in professional football, whether it's a player or on the staff, you are in a bubble. It is what I used to call the football bubble. Everything's done for you. You know, you're shipped around the world. You're told when to eat. You're told when to turn up. And it's all discipline. And even more so now. For someone like James Milner at 37, still doing it, the way the game's fought. I mean, I played till I was 36, but it wasn't quite the level and the speed of the game that is today. So, you know, for him to do that as well is quite remarkable. But, you know, yeah, now it doesn't surprise me at all what he's doing at Worthing, because he will be infectious. The whole family's infectious with football. That's all they've ever done. That's all they've ever known, sure, from young kids right through the family. So for him to be passing on his knowledge now and seeing his son in the first team is, you know, you could write a book about it, really.
Absolutely. So when a few years ago, I had the lucky happenstance to interview Adam. So as well, it was still at Worthing. I think it was probably just pre-COVID. And I went over there to Woodside Road to interview him. It was great, and all the people looked after us. But there was one particular incident that I showed, certainly the various board members at Worthing, and they hadn't seen before. So when I asked Adam about it, he blamed the coaches here. Now, do you know what I'm talking about here, Bob? Okay, so I think the game was Boxing Day. I could be wrong. It was against Colchester United. Adam Hinshelwood plays a big back pass from about the halfway line. It's at with Dean. John Sullivan, I believe, is the goalkeeper. I apologise if I'm actually sullying him, and it was, excuse the pun, and it was someone else.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a great own goal. And to this day, Hinch says, well, I blame the coaches because they told Sully to be in one place and told us to do something else. Get a comment, Bob.
It's never the players' fault, is it? It's always down to us, you know. Yeah. Players don't get the sack, do they? Only managers and coaches.
Actually, it's not too dissimilar to the way we play now, actually. I mean, it was a pass. He was in the fullback position and he was passing back to the goalkeeper, but the goalkeeper was in no position to receive the ball, and it was a no-look pass, really. I just ended up in the back.
Anyway, we're talking about Hinshelwood family here, Justin. Let's bring you in here. Now, you've obviously seen the rise of Hinch since he, or Hinch Jr., the latest junior, since...
Baby Hinch.
Well, yeah. Now, I think, isn't there going to be toddler Hinch coming through soon as well? Give us your first impressions of his first, what, half dozen games for the Albion.
The first time I really got a good look at him was the Villa away game, which is quite traumatic. he did okay in that game, but in general the team had a pretty poor game. But because that was his first outing in kind of the centre of midfield, so I think my feeling then was, you know, maybe it's his inclusion that's had an effect on the team, even though he wasn't that bad. Since then, he is very much a sort of a central midfielder. And so he's obviously playing out of position, which you expect from seasoned pros like Pascal Gross. But when you're 18, to be playing in a position that you probably haven't played a lot at a youth level, he performed it really well, actually. He can sneak into the box for a goal or two, but he's always, his positional sense is way, way above his years as a right back. He's in the right place at the right time, and that's a bit I find really impressive at the moment. His touch is Premier League level. His vision is Premier League level, but that positioning, that's a man in a boy's body. So, that's incredible. The other thing I've seen, I'm not sure if you guys have seen it, but there were some clips of him in the youth teams, and he sort of developed this speciality of taking a kickoff at the beginning of the game in the centre, and then chipping the keeper with like second touch, which I thought was quite good. But yeah, he's got a very big future ahead of him, and I think we've only seen a small. We've just seen the tip of the iceberg. I think there's a lot more
to come for it. Now, Bob, I mean, obviously, Hinch is just in the team at the moment because of the amount of injuries we've got at the moment. I mean, it's quite a crippling list. And obviously, we're starting to see some bodies come back now. Now, obviously, I mean, you've worked with the young players and you've developed quite a few of them yourself, and he's now going to be, is he like a permanently in the side now, or is he going to be dripped in and out of the side once the players start coming back?
Well, a lot of managers treat the youngsters in the team, you know, you can go two ways. You can just carry on playing him, and then, or, you know, after a few games now, because they go in there and they play with no fear, they just go with the flow and they do what they do and they're up and down. And then sometimes you would take them out and give them a bit of a breather. I think it was a little bit after he scored the first goal. I think he got taken off then. And that's just like a little bit of mind games to the manager saying, okay, let's get your feet back on the ground. So, you know, it's all about the man management. But knowing this manager, if he's doing the business and he's in the structure of what he wants that team to do that night, then I can't see him being out of the team. You know, even, you know, when the likes of some of them come back, you know, mainly the players we have lost is wingers. You know, we've lost March, Fatty, Matoma, Adringa. We've lost all them wide players, which isn't really Hinch's favourite position. But just like Justin said, you know, he might end up playing in their midfield with Gross, et cetera, et cetera. He's got the ability to do it. And I think the good thing for Jack at the moment as well, let's not forget he's got some quality players around him now.
Yeah.
No, he's not playing in the youth team. You know, he's going to be getting the ball a lot more. He's going to be getting better information, you know, that they're going to be teaching him things on and off the ball. It's only going to make him like a better player. And he's already spoke about, you know, he listens to Pascal Gross as a father and James Milner. You know, that must be precious for him. You know, Anna Lallana, you know, all the, you know, Lewis Dunk, you know, all this information on a daily basis that we don't see on the training pitch. That is priceless for that young player. I mean, he's just got to be taking so much information. He's got to put on hold a little bit because he'll get brainwashed with it all. But it's great for him because he won't want to come out of the team. And fair play to the manager. He's, you know, he's put him in there and he's reaping the benefits from it. You know, look at Solly March. You know, under Graham Potter, whatever you think, Solly March was a good established player. But I always felt that he needed that end product and get some goals. New manager comes in, puts his arm around him. He hasn't coached him that much, I wouldn't have thought. He just put his arm around him and said, listen, I want you to shoot more. I want you to cross more. You know, I want you to do this. And he's man-managed him. And there's the rewards in Solly March right away. You know, he's more than an established player now. You know, if he was to come
up. Is it a massive miss as well, isn't it? Okay, well let's get into those sort of tactical innovations, for want of a better phrase. Now, obviously, when you've worked under various different managers, obviously under Mickey Adams and Peter Taylor, it was more of an old school style. You worked under Steve Coppell, which was more cerebral, more like tactical. And now you're watching us. Let's give Graham Potter some credit as well. That was innovative as well. But how do you see it under De Zerbi, and how do you coach that?
Well, I should imagine. I mean, I spoke to a few of the players, and, you know, first and foremost, it was a bit of a culture shock from the Graham Potter techniques, or what, the way he was coaching. It was off another level. You know, his attention to detail was phenomenal, and it is on a daily basis. I mean, this fella just eats and breathes football. He's just like on another scale. You know, he's you know, I'm lucky enough to do the tour, and we go down, and we used to do the tour into the dressing rooms, which we still do, but it got changed because he didn't want the players sitting in the dressing room too long, because it, you know, it wasn't the place to have a meeting. So he then moved it, and that all changed at the Chelsea game. And I remember speaking to Lewis Dunk about it, and he sort of said, you know, it's been very difficult because we've been used to Graham Potter's voice, and you get used to a Mickey Adams voice and his way of coaching, or Steve Coppell. And if the players take it on board, that's what you want. If they don't, doesn't matter what the quality of the player is. If the player doesn't believe in what you're trying to coach, it all goes downhill. Mourinho at Man United, you could have the best players in the world, but if you can't put them into a shape and get them to play that he wants them to play, it counts for nothing. And so that was a difficult turning period for Roberto to come in. But he didn't change it dramatically, in my view. It changed before the Chelsea game when he brought the players in at a different time to have their pre-match meal. He had a team meeting at a different time when it comes to that Chelsea game. You know, a little bit of mind games with Graham Potter, and we go and spank them 4-5-0, whatever it was. And that was, for me, that was the turning point where he got the players, or the players got him, in my opinion, what I saw of it and what I know from the inside. So, you know, once you've got a group of players on board with you, you know, it's, you just roll. You know, even in the old days with me and Mickey, once the team was on a roll and you didn't have to coach them much, you know, they'd done the team talk at half time for you, you know, albeit ripping each other's throats out in the dressing room, which I can't really see happening these days, but that's the way it was. We'd be walking off the pitch and, you know, Mickey'd say, like, just leave them to it. You know, we're losing 0-0, and you come in and, you know, there's Bobby Zamora having a scrap with Danny Cullett, and Danny Cullett got him by the throat saying, when are you going to start running around? You know, you're costing me my bonus. And we go out and win one. We go out and win one, and Bobby Zamora scores a goal. That's not coaching. That's just putting a group of players together that you believe in, and they go and have a go for you. And the players must be relishing in, we're finally getting recognition in the Premier League from a lot of pundits, which at first really got my throat up, because no one was recognised what this fella was trying to do or what the players were trying to do and how good we were. And now it's all out there now. So sometimes it's a bit hairy at the back there, but he ain't going to change his philosophy, and the players have bought into it. They're going to keep doing it, and long may it continue. We're sitting seventh in the league. Frustrating last night. We're sitting above Man United. We're sitting above Chelsea. We're sitting above Newcastle. That ain't bad after Christmas. All you CEOs out there, let's remember where we came from. Yeah, we've had some dizzy heights and we've had some very, very lows, but we are in the Premier League. And we are now, in my opinion, an established Premier League team. When you're in the Premier League for the first couple of years, you're not. You're just in there to stick in there. And now people can turn around and say, we are a Premier League team, well established.
Absolutely. I was thinking of that actual phrase, oddly enough, earlier today. Can we consider ourselves an established Premier League team? I think we clearly can now, and if nothing else, because, let's put it this way, we're not relegation fodder anymore, at least not for the time being. We don't know. For all the fact that the way that the Tony's running the club and Paul's got his hands on the Jack and Jill, and you've got, you know, someone as amazing as Roberto De Zerbi in charge and so on and so forth. And with a club our size, that is actually still one of the bottom six in terms of resources. How long is this going to last? Is it sustainable? And the point is that the business model has to be sustainable. And if other clubs are going to run their football clubs like cash cows or laundering outfits or whatever it might be, that's their business. We're going to try and run it as efficiently as possible. It's going to be run at a loss. It just is. And for all the plaudits, and this is what picking up on what Bob just said just now, we've got all these various pundits saying, oh, Brighton's such a well-run club. I mean, it's a case of, you know, getting a player in for 5 million and selling him for 10, 15, 20 times that amount. Yeah, that's seen as good business. But I think even that misses the point. It's nothing. It doesn't mean anything. If you're going to sell someone for £100 million, if they're not going to be replaced. Mm-hmm. And we've got that conveyor belt. We've got the next one off the cab rank is nearly ready. But Justin, in your opinion, how long would it be there for, if we're now an established Premier League side, before we actually can consider ourselves an established top half side?
That's an interesting question. I was talking to a Fulham fan at work. He said to me, I just want to win something. We just need to win something. That's what we need to do. They've obviously been in the final of the Europa Cup. And so they've had, maybe higher level than us, but I think that's where we're at, and it's just getting that. I think it's obviously a few years of consistent top 10 finishes, but we've got to look like a team that could win something. And I think and we need to be a team that's talked about winning things, and obviously we're not at the moment, but I think that's the key.
You get us over the line.
Yeah.
It's not a quick fix, is it? You might have we're still in the FA Cup. Let's not forget we're still in the Europa Cup.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We were down and out the first couple of games, and now we're in the knockout stages. You know, there's no rule out there saying that we can't go and win this thing, I tell you.
We like to beat West Ham, we like to beat Liverpool, and we think we could beat AC Milan. Okay, let's go through the rest of them. All this Feyenoord, Galatasaray, Marseille again, Shakhtar, that would be an interesting one. Yeah, and so on and so forth.
Do you think the manager's turning around to players and say, well, let's see if we can get as far as we can? Lewis, don't the other night, we want to go and win it.
Yeah, and I bet it would be. I will bet it'll be one of those things where if he plays AC Milan, and this is an Italian fella saying this, you lose to AC Milan, none of you are getting paid.
Well, you know, that's the way that how far this club is. And the most important thing is where the club's come from, what the base is. I mean, Paul Barber was on the radio this week, and he said, you know, in our 123-year history, we've only actually spent 11 seasons at the top in the top division. And we spent 14 of those 123 years being homeless. So we're still homeless for longer than we've actually been in the Premier League in our entire history. That's the base of where we come from. And now we have got Roberto and, you know, and the fact that it really hurt him losing to Man United in the FA Cup semi-final last season. And he is hungry for success. He will want to get to the final. He'll want to win that. And he'll want to, in the Europa League, he'll want to win that. He's a winner. He wants to win everything. He does not like losing.
No, of course. But the interesting the point you're making now is that now that we're actually part of the chattering classes and the people across the world are actually talking about us, I love the fact that Chelsea fans are talking about us, especially those overseas, are talking about us so dismissively and so pejoratively. I'm thinking, I really can't be bothered to actually come up with some kind of new rivalry with Chelsea. I would find it insulting, and I have to have a lobotomy in order just to get down to their intellectual level. So let's not go down that route. But my point will be is here we are in the position we're at. I'm 99% certain we have not hit the ceiling yet. Because we're now part of a discussion, people are also looking at the fact of where we've come from, as you say, AD. And I have to say this, that we've got one of those people who played such a massive part in those kind of, you know, look where we were 25 years ago. Now, obviously, Bob wasn't with us 25 years ago, but he played a massive part in doing the things that he did that kept the club afloat and that kept the club on the right direction and got everyone facing the right way. So, Bob, when you first came here, and probably even when you last left as a coach, I mean, just to give a flavour to those who are, well, basically are under 40. Sorry, mate, it is that long ago. About Brighton and what it was then, and certainly in comparison to who we are now.
Because we have come such a long way in a very short amount of time. And, you know, Tony Bloom and Paul Barber and everybody at that football club, you know, my aim was to get to the Amex. And I just fell short of that. And that's the nature of the business. But, it, you know, when I sat down with Tony Bloom and he was making the change, yes, I was hurt. Yes, I was hurt. But you know, he thanked me for my services and he thanked me for 11 years of working for the football club. And it meant so much to me. You know, a lot of people say you can go away and be bitter and, oh, you know, you've had the sack and all this. That was far out of my mind. I was just privileged to have helped the football club to get as far as it could. But it needed the next level. And Tony and Paul Barber and the Amex is where we needed to go. And I would have loved to have been sitting in that dugout, but it fell short, or I fell short, or, you know, we fell short when whatever manager was there. But to work from that early stages when I was invited down and I was just the youth team manager at Brentford and Mickey Adams was the manager at Brentford and he got the sack and I hadn't known him that long. And when he walked out of that office, he said, I love the way you work. I'm going to come and get you. I went, oh, that'd be very nice. And, you know, a few months later, he rung me up and said, would you like to come down to Brighton? I said, what, as youth team manager? He said, no, I'd like you to be my assistant manager. Alan Cork's left. And it was a bit of a dreamland for me. So I went straight into the office at Brentford. And
sorry, hang on, Bob, can I just pause there? Going to Brighton while we were with Dean, training out in the open, avoiding the cowpats while training, was a dream.
I didn't know that at the stage. Mickey didn't tell me that. He just said, get your ass down here. Go and tell Brentford you're leaving, you're resigning, which I did. And they was a bit surprised at that. But I went within the day. And then I drove down to Brighton and I turned up at the university, which I thought was a bit strange for a training ground at the stage at a professional football club. And then we went down to Topolino's to meet Dick, the chairman.
Yeah.
Saccolino's.
Yeah, I've just renamed that Saccolino's. I've been down there and that's where Dick sat me, Saccolino's. But Dick sat there and, you know, he said, you know, what's your philosophies? And I said, well, you know, I like attacking football. I just, you know, I like young players to be in the team if possible, if they're good enough. And he sold the stadium to me and said, oh, we're getting a new stadium in 2 years. I thought, oh, well, that's not so bad. Where are we at the moment? He said, well, we're a place called Rivdean, which has just got a running track around it. So when I finally saw Rivdean, I thought, have I made the right decision here? But, you know, it was the next move for me, and the rest was history. And I think, you know, in all fairness, I think I can say this for a lot of Seagull supporters, that I think Mickey, yeah, we've had some unbelievable stories staying in the Football League, which I wasn't part of that, and it must have been amazing. Mickey was. But I think Mickey was the start, what I call the start of the revolution.
Yeah.
You know, I worked under six managers, and they was all really good characters. You know, they were different in every aspect. You know, me and Mickey were very good working and a social relationship. Peter Taylor, not quite so. It was all about Peter did all the coaching. I was just sort of picking the cones up, really, to be honest. But we still had a good working relationship. Steve Coppell was brilliant. He really involved me and let me do a lot of the coaching and things like that. Mark McGee, again, you know, I really hit it off with Mark. I'd never met him before. And as soon as we met, we ended up sort of talking about how we played against each other when he was at Newcastle and I was at Sheffield United at Bramall Lane. And so we hit it off as well. And then we had Hinch, which is a very difficult time, as we all know. So I was blessed, really. I mean, I really feel that working with all the managers really stood me in good stead for my coaching career, because they all did things different ways. I learned so much from them. And it was a little bit strange, because every time the manager went, I thought normally you would go, because they bring their own staff in, the next manager. But Dick made it quite clear to me that I was staying as the assistant manager, albeit after 6 months, if the manager didn't want you, he was within his rights to ask for some different staff. So when that sort of got to that stage, you know, 4, 5, 6 months, I started to think to myself, am I doing the job for this manager? And
you just made yourself useful.
Well, this is it. You know, I love the role of being the assistant, because I like to organise, I like to be disciplined. You know, I think I was a good link between a lot of the players to the manager, if they come through me or they go straight to the manager. And I really enjoyed that role. I never wanted to be a manager. And the times that I was caretaker was an absolute nightmare. Not because of the results, but the whole thing changes. The players look at me thinking, oh, is he going to be the gaffer? Is he Bob? You know, can we strip him on the training pitch and chuck him in the river? You know, all these sort of things. So, you know, that was a very, very special time with the squads that came through their managers. And we had some really good players, and none of them should be forgotten, because that's where we are today, and it's all moved on, and that's the way it's had to be, and it needed to be.
Yeah. But that's my point here, Bob. I mean, the thing I'm saying about it is, and I think I'm more addressing those who are a slightly younger. They don't realise that actually, I think that without the stability, like I say, I mean, there was Dick and obviously Martin at the top of the club, and then there was that kind of stability, that kind of spine of yourself being there, that if you hadn't been there, there could have been slightly more anarchic. Now, I'm just thinking of the early days of Withdean, and you mentioned about sort of 01, 02, and, you know, there was a bit of a zeitgeist going on in Brighton. There was, you know, there was new government. Brighton was centre of attention. Fat Boy Slim was happening. There was the big beach boutique, and the Christ, how lucky did we get away with that? And Bobby Zamora was a name, and there was Mickey and Bob doing the business and what have you. And there was that first half of that time at Withdean, there was a magical time. Yeah, there was promotions and relegations. It wasn't stable on the pitch, but there was the attempts at stability off the pitch. It was got a little bit wayward in the second half and thank God we got the stadium approved, because then eventually it focused people once again. Mm. Rather than protesting about it, we got it. But I think this is the point I'm making here, and maybe I can bring in Justin here, is that one of those things that was the spine of the club, the thing that actually held it together, the glue that meant that we could do this, was that there was someone like yourself who could actually hold it all together and bring people in. There was, you know, there was something about you that said, you know, we're going to do this together, whatever way we do it, and we'll do it with a smile on our face and a song in our hearts. You were, the for me, the epitome of that time. Justin, I mean, does that ring a bell with you?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's about the continuity, isn't it? And,
yeah.
And having a number of people who were there throughout the vast majority of that journey. From with the to the Amex. So yeah, I get that definitely.
Right. Okay. Well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As ever, this show is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil's given us yet another lovely shirt for us to have a quick look at. Have you got it there, Bob?
What is it, the one with Bonetti on?
Yeah, that's the one.
What team is that? Is it an Australian team or something?
That's what we're trying to get you to guess.
I think it's Australian.
You're right. It is Australian. How'd you know that?
Yeah, it's the kangaroo.
I've been to Australia just before lockdown, and I remember seeing that shirt.
Well, there you go.
Okay, well, just to give a better description of that, because just to say it's Australian doesn't really cut it. It's a black and white striped shirt. Yeah. You could argue it's Newcastle. You could argue it's Juventus. There is a badge on there that's, again, a black and white striped shield badge. It's got a kangaroo and a...
There's your clue.
And it looks like a stuffed donkey on its back legs.
Wallaby.
Is that what it is? Okay. It's got National Premier Leagues as one of the badges. Bonetti, I doubt very much anything to do with the former Chelsea goalkeeper. Transport and Hire are the sponsors. As for the team themselves, again, I think Phil has mucked about with the photoshopping as to who it might be. So I'm just going to pick a nominal A-League side. I don't even know that many A-League sides, so I'm just going to name a city and say Brisbane just for the sheer hell of it.
Justin, no, you've got Brisbane.
I mean, yeah, it's the kangaroo definitely points down under, doesn't it? I'm going to go with Adelaide United just because we've been heavily linked with a goalkeeper. He might be on.
Signed the goalkeeper.
We
just signed a goalkeeper from Adelaide City. It is.
Oh, it's Adelaide City.
But yeah, and you're right, that's who it is. And this is what Phil has to say about this particular jersey. He says, here is your shirt of the week. And it is the 2021 home shirt of South Australia's Adelaide City, who play in the National Premier League of South Australia. The NPL is the second flight of football in Australia, which is split into 8 regions, 6 of which are larger than England. Home is the 5,500 capacity Adelaide City Park, and the side is nicknamed the Zebras for obvious reasons. And also Juventus, after the Italian community who formed the side in 1946. And they were originally named Adelaide Juventus. They originally wanted to wear black and white striped kits, but the rules of South Australian Soccer Federation insisted that only one club could wear that combination. And Port Adelaide FC had the precedent. Adelaide Juventus played in navy blue shirts with a large white J stitched into the front of it until the Federation relented in 1949. City are one of the most decorated sides in Australian football. They were the founding members of the National Soccer League in 1977, which they won 3 times. They also won the NSL Cup, which is their version of the FA Cup, 3 times, and the OFC Champions League in 1987. In addition, they won more than 50 state titles. In 2003, the cost associated with national football in Australia meant that they withdrew from the National League and have played in the state competition ever since. Some notable former players with links to the UK include John Aloisi, who spent 4 seasons in England with Portsmouth and Coventry between 1997 and 2001. He started his career with Adelaide. Tony Vidmar played 140 times for Adelaide before he moved to Europe in 1995. And during his time in the Northern Hemisphere, he played for Rangers, Middlesbrough and Cardiff City. Links to the Albion? Well, there is one. And the one old and one new, in fact. Justin Fashanu went to Adelaide City on loan from Norwich between 1980 and 1981. Justin played for 22 different teams during his professional career, including the Albion, with 16 league games for us between 85 and 87. And bang up to date, Brighton have just signed Adelaide City's goalkeeper, Stephen Hall. Stephen is just 19, and he also played for the Australia under-21s and under-23 sides. So thank you for that. And of course, you can see this and over 130,000 other shirts over at oldfootballshirts.com.
Justin, I'm sorry about this, but we have to talk about last night's game. We can put aerial music on in the background if you want. But what happened?
You know what? The first 10 minutes was sort of okay. We had kind of 5 shots. we dominated possession, and it was kind of looking good. It was almost at that point, you know, we're going to score in a minute, and then we kind of did it, and it got to 10 minutes and we didn't, and it just kept on going. The Wolves put in a fantastic low block, and it's sort of one of the ways, or most successful ways, to play a deserved team. You do a low block, you've got a couple of fast wingers who kind of hang about the flanks, and if the ball gets loose, you just kick it into the wings and hope one of them picks it up, and you hit us on the break. And we got hit a couple of times. Luckily, the punches did land. But yeah, most of the time, most of the match was played in Wolves' half, with the ball kind of going in a semicircle back and forth around the around penalty area, with the kind of players not really wanting to shoot, not really knowing what to do with it. And yeah, we ran out of ideas. I think we were still in Dubai, weren't we?
Now, Bob, I mean, you, obviously, with your coaching hat on, this has been a problem for the Albion under the Zerbia, well, and under Graham Potter, and quite a lot of sides. But how do you beat a low block?
Just being patient. You only get 90 minutes, and I always get a bit frustrated with games last night, not because we didn't win the game. I look at it and think we didn't get beat. And you've got to remember, in the Premier League now, the other team's trying to beat you.
Yeah.
You've got to give other teams respect, especially for someone like Wolves, you know, at five on the spin away from home. You've got to respect that, you know, and you can, it's like chopping the tree down. You know, you get to the edge of the box. Yes, could we have shot a bit earlier? Yes. Other games we have. We didn't concede last night. So, I think as a coach, I would take that as a positive last night, because we always concede, but we always end up scoring. So it was a little bit the other way last night. We didn't score, but we didn't concede.
Yeah.
That's a bit of a plus, albeit at home, after being away and having a break. So with your coaching head on, I just look at it and think, well, hang on a minute, we're still seventh in the league. We picked up another point. You might say another point near the safety, some people might take it. But I think there's a lot of supporters out there, and I hear them after the game saying, oh, we only drew tonight. I get that frustration, but you've got to look at the overall picture.
Absolutely.
You know, we're about without a lot of players. It's not an excuse. We've got rid of a lot of players. Look at the amount of players this club's had a turnover, you know, since the manager has come. Incredible. And to have that transition in the start of the season, losing your manager, losing Cucurella, losing McAllister, and still produce the football that we're producing with the players that have come in, almost a lot of them unknown, squad numbers, 47, 48, et cetera, is nothing short of a miracle for what this football club's done. And I just want people to realise that it's not a conveyor belt. Oh, yeah, we're up there at seventh, we should be winning every game. It ain't going to work like that.
No, it doesn't.
Especially the way we're playing, we're going to be vulnerable. But on the counter side of that, when we are vulnerable, if it doesn't go in like it did last night, yes, we got the other side of them to punish them, which most games we have done and we score. It didn't happen last night.
Yeah.
So you got to hold your hat up and say, well done, Wolves, you nicked a point. There we go. We move on to the next one.
There was a paucity of ambition from Wolves though, at certain points. I mean, basically, they came for the point and they went home with a point. So in that case, congratulations to them. And I've got to applaud some of their defending, which was magnificent at times. But when they were attacking, there were times when they were only committing one player forward. And if they had committed two, it would have been a simple tap-in for somebody, because it was not great. But actually, Justin, I do think that this was we've been without Matoma, Odinga, Solly for a little while, and we've done okay. I think this was probably the first time we've actually really missed them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as you can see, so fat as well.
Yeah.
You add it up, that's probably £200 million worth of talent missing. So what team in the Premier League could win with that sort of time? It's not just any player. These are our creative players. These are the players who can do something a bit.
Right, a spark.
Who can unlock or break down the wall. Yeah. I mean, we've still got those players, but having those five available, and you look at the return fixture, it was March was unbelievable in that game, and Ciso ripped them apart, and Mitoma scored, you know, potential goal of the season in that game. So they were, their Wolves must have been rubbing their paws together, you know. As soon as they,
oh, nicely done.
They would have been they would have been howling at the moon after that that last match.
Can you come? I think you made a very good point, Justin. I think you made a very good point
there, and you picked out, you know, players like Fatty was just coming into his own as we lost him, which was a big shame. And over here in Mallorca, they speak of him very highly because they're all Barcelona fans over here. And the likes of Mitoma and Adringo, if we'd have had them, if we didn't, but like the manager made a good comment, we haven't had any wingers for a few games now. You know, we've got Jack Incherwood going down one side. We had Milner like last night, and Gross gets out there. They're not wingers. They're not going to knock the ball and go past people like Fatty and Mitoma does. So, you know, on another night, if them players are in the team, 8% of the time we're going to get behind them, and it's going to be a tap-in for Joao Pedro or Danny Welbeck or Ferguson or whoever's playing.
Yeah, sure.
We didn't manage to get ourselves in that position last night, not because we didn't want to. We tried, but we didn't really have the personnel to do it.
No, well, just rewind like 20-odd years. What would that dressing room have said with the likes of Danny Cullip and Charlie Oakway in it? What would they say if we signed a player with a £1 billion release clause? How would they react to that?
Well, I'm not sure it would have lasted too long in the dressing room, I've got to be honest.
I'm not sure if she told us that actually the radio station would be allowed to continue.
It was a different era then, wasn't it? You know, we keep saying about the old days, it was a different era.
Again, as we say, actually so pivotal in the continuity in the history of the Albion. I mean, we could have actually spent all those years with Dean just sort of treading water in the middle of the fourth division. We didn't. Yeah. We punched above our weight so ridiculously. We spent three seasons out of those 12 in the Championship. I mean, obviously you get there on merit, but when you look at it now, you think how difficult it was for us to get out of the Championship once we got into the Amex, and that's with a huge leg up. It says something. We were able to actually spend 3 years in that division, albeit struggling for most of the season, just because of the nature of the resources of all the other big clubs versus what, you know, this kind of that near hand-to-mouth existence that we had with Dean. But, you know, and we're back to Bob again. You know, it's those kind of things that, but for him, you know, with Dean, could have been a turgid time. And I'm sorry to blow smoke up your ass quite so dramatically here, Bob, but I'm so pleased to be talking to someone who, for me, played such a major part in the history of the Albion.
Well, we was all in it, you know, it's very kind words, and I'm sort of proud of what, not what I achieved, but what we achieved as a football club and a group of people. You know, down the offices, we had Derek Allen and Sally Townsend and Brian Townsend, you know, and Edward David. You know, these four people down there were working their pops off, you know, trying to get our wages together. And then, you know, we had a squad of players that, you know, were on ridiculous amounts of money, next to nothing, you know, and prepared to run through a brick wall for the likes of us coaching staff, you know. And we asked a lot of them, and they kept giving. And I don't think them sort of times will ever be repeated, and because times have moved on. Mm. But that was, like you say, that was a very, very special time. And it's not sad, but probably the modern day players at the Albion now, some of them won't even be aware of, well, I walk past a lot of them, they don't even know who I am. I could be the steward on the door, you know what I mean? That's no.
Yeah, we've seen you play steward, though.
Well, it's no disrespect to them. It's, you know, some of them might be aware. I mean, Dunkey would have probably sort of, they've gone, blimey, you've been here for all these years. You know, what was it like then? You know, the conversations might have come up, but I wouldn't expect it to. But at least in our hearts and our players' hearts, when I still speak to some of that old group of players, we all feel as if we've played a part in getting to the football club where it is today. And that's important, you know. You know, Nicky doing all that, you know, all that walking up to Downing Street and protesting for the football club and being on the radio about it. You know, we've all played a little part of that. You guys there, you've been, you know, when I speak to a lot of people down at the Amex now, and when I'm doing my hospitality, and I say, how long have you been a Brighton supporter? And I say, only since the Amex has opened. And my face drops a little bit, but I get it because it's now a corporate business and they want to be part of that. But when I talk to people, say, I used to go to Gillingham when I was at the Goldstone and I did all the Withdean days, I shake their hand and say, well done, you guys. You deserve that. You've been through all that and you've come out at the top and you should relish every minute of this now, what Tony Bloom and the football club and
Paul Believe Barber. Me, Bob, we are.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, I mean, that's how far we've come. And we're absolutely delighted to see. I mean, obviously, we've got the stateside Seagulls, the Spanish Seagulls. We've got fans all around the world. It's like a come one, come all. I mean, obviously, we've all been there. We've got us guys that are a bit longer in the tooth. We've been around. We've done all of the grounds. But, you know, it doesn't matter whether you've been a fan for one day or been whether you've been a fan for 20 years. It.
Got the poncho. It's as simple as that. Yeah.
Love that. Yeah.
Actually, and while you're here, is Nicky still next to you?
Yes.
Nicky, do you want to move in next to Bob? Because like it or lump it, we're gonna doorstep you here.
Woman here, she's been a massive part of my life, especially coming out of football, because that was a very difficult time for me, and she was my rock. I've got to say that, and she's been absolutely unbelievable, and she's a bloody good broadcaster, but she's taught me so much, especially with my hospitality job on doing the work down at Brighton now. You know, she's been great knowledge, and she's a Brighton fan through and through. She's been a fan longer than I know. So the fact that she didn't have a clue who I was when she first saw me on the balcony at home doing with Freddie Mercury. She's Bernie, who's that idiot? And John Byrne said, that's the assistant manager, Bob Booker. She went, really? And now I am. I ended up marrying her, and we're now living in Mallorca. So
if I can introduce you properly here, this is Nicky Kegshevrin, and those of a certain age and disposition will remember her as broadcasting from on Southern FM for probably more the years than she cares to remember. It's fair to say, and we can say this on Zoom, that she hasn't changed a bit, which is also really unfair. But Nicky, I mean, Bob's just pulled you in there. To talk about sort of his time at the Albion and obviously that sort of you two eventually ended up together, but as a broadcaster for Southern FM and all the times that you had to talk about the Albion, give us your memories of all the nonsense that we went through and how you had to broadcast upon it.
Oh, it was really tough times. I mean, I was lucky enough to interview Tony Blair on two occasions when he was Prime Minister, and both times I got into him and I was going, come on, what are we going to do about getting this ground sorted for the Albion, you know, because it was going on and on and on. And, you know, we did all those marches and everything, and it's funny because, I mean, I loved the Withdean days. I missed the Withdean days because it was our own little sort of secure area, and I know that we needed new ground, and it's fantastic we got the ground, obviously, because the annex is amazing. But I think it's good that we went through all those hard times, really, to appreciate now what we have. Mm-hmm. And for us to be playing the football we're playing now is just incredible. And I think De Zerbi is amazing. I love that man.
Okay. Yeah. And she says this with her husband right next to her, by the way.
Yeah, there was a glint in the eye.
I'm not led anywhere near the Italian.
And Nicky, actually, while you're on here, there's actually just one other thing I wanted to raise here. And as someone of radio and someone who's a Brighton fan, can you also just give us an appreciation of probably the Queen of Radio who passed away recently, Annie Nightingale? I mean, what did she mean to you?
Oh, well, without Annie Nightingale, I wouldn't have done the job that I did for so many years. I mean, she started it off for everybody, and she was a one-off, and it was very, very sad to hear of her passing. I was very moved by that. I never got to meet her, unfortunately, but I was always a huge fan.
So when you say, you know, if it wasn't for her, I mean, would you have not considered a career in radio then?
No, I don't think I would really, because even when I started, I mean, I sort of fell into radio about 1985. And at that point, there were very, very few female broadcasters, particularly ones on their own. I mean, obviously, I did a lot of double heading broadcasting, but, you know, she used to broadcast on her own. And that was sort of complete rarity. I mean, obviously, now it's gone completely the other end of the scale, and it's all female broadcasters everywhere you look. Some good, some bad. But, you know, yeah, she really, I think, started it for us lady broadcasters.
about to say, I mean, we're talking about With Dean there, and I'm forever grateful to With Dean because of the very makeup of the way it was, and the fact that everyone had to all congregate in the same way. I basically made friends from life pretty much through that, through the marches.
Sorry about that.
I know, yeah, good. But it was a very, very special life raft for us. And, like, you know, it's something that was special. And obviously, we have got the Amex now, and it is very different to what we had to go through. But, you know, without it, I don't think we'd be where we are now.
Well,
I agree.
Sorry, go on.
I used to get to the With Dean, but, you know, quite a few hours before any game, because obviously I was getting ready to do broadcasts or interviews, etc. And I could walk around that ground, and I would practically know every person in that ground. And it was lovely. It was such a great community. And I think that really helped maybe with the team as well, knowing that it was all such a big bond and we're all in it together.
Yeah. Let's get to the fact that it was a dump, wasn't it? But it was it was our dump.
Yeah.
You know, it was our dump. So I always tell this little story, if I could tell this quickly, when I'm doing the hospitality. We had a groundsman down at the time called Steve Winterburn.
Oh, yeah, I know Steve, yeah.
In the afternoons, I'd go down there and he would be dragging in one hose pipe around the pitch trying to get some water onto the pitch. He'd have one lawnmower and he had one fork to do the divots and a bag of sand.
True.
And to see him, when I see him now, I point out to people, I said, look, see that bloke over there? He was at the With Dean with us. He was on his own, right, on a frozen pitch, etc. And I'd go down there and drag the hoses around. And for him now to be at the Amex and at the training ground with the staff he's got behind him, that is another great story because he's done unbelievable. And that's just part of the backroom staff of probably a lot of people now at the Amex and were connected with the With Dean a little bit, you know. So for them, however far they were down the chain, you know, the shop people or the burger people or people selling programs to be at the Amex now, they've all played their part as well. They've come through it, so we're all in it together.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the point I want, just taking on Nicky's point, was that, you know, there was a lot of friendships that were made, but then it was the nature of the fact that the fans who started protesting, and they were protesting 95 to 97, before it was then turned to while we were With Dean campaigning, that because everyone had to face the same way, was in the same boat, and had to do it. And it was a lot more open and democratic because, I mean, there were times where I could actually probably argue that it was probably a bit too open with how the club was run because, like I say, everyone knew everyone else. And sometimes we got to know things that, frankly, we just don't know about the football club nowadays. And on a certain level, I think that level of professionalism is actually probably a bit more appropriate. But as you say, it was not just a fans' campaign. It was a club's campaign. I mean, when you look at the fact that Paul Samra was the one who led it, and if ever, you know, it's great that Tony and Paul have got their gongs, but if anyone else deserves a gong, then it's Paul Samra for me. I mean, the fella, without his work, I mean, without several people's work, without his work, I think we wouldn't have the stadium. So, yeah, the whole thing was so much more open and democratic. So your point, Nicky, about going around the stadium and realising that of the 6,000 crowd, there was probably only about 20 people you didn't know.
Mm.
It's, and I think it's probably unique amongst professional football clubs, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, and that is all we've got time for. So, of course, thank you to Alan Ware. Thank you to Justin Brednell for not saying very much, but it's lovely to see you anyway. Thank you to Bob Booker. Thank you to Nicky Keg Shevlin. And I've been AD Packham, and this has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all again next week. Cheers. Bye.